In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened, while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west, across the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between its eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing behind the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in the place of it, four notable horns came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast down truth to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of the desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Verse 15. Then it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." And he came near and I stood, and when I came and was afraid and fell on my face, he said to me, "Understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright and said, 'Look, I'm making known to you what will happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time, the end shall be. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of the Medes and the Persians, or Media and Persia. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall rise out of that nation, but none with its power.'" Verse 23, "And in the latter times, their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive, and shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future." Verse 27, "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. And probably neither do you. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, we saw that Daniel had a dream and a vision, and God showed him that there would be kingdoms raised up in the last days, and from the last kingdom, there would be 10 horns, and from that 10 horns, one horn would arise, and we've talked about that being the Antichrist that is mentioned in the book of Revelation. Here in Daniel chapter 8, we have some horns also, but in my opinion, they are horns that are different than the other horns, though they do give us a picture of the other horns to a degree, or other horn. So we have this a second vision, and this is the beginning of when Daniel begins to write the book in the book of in the language of the Hebrews. From chapter 2 up through chapter 7, the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic, the language of the Babylonians of that day. Now we see Daniel begins to write it in Hebrew. And we begin to see clearly that there is certain things in this chapter. Now, what's different about this chapter in chapter 7? Chapter 7 does not give us clear understanding of who the lion and the bear is. And so we had to speculate some. I gave you a couple of possible interpretations, gave you my opinion. Some of you told me you disagreed. Praise the Lord. It's okay. But here, we actually have the identification of who this ram is and who this goat is. And it's very clear. And, you know, if you're visiting church today and you came in here and thought, what in the world are these people reading? This really is the Bible. And this story is genuine, and we'll give you the interpretation. In fact, in verses 20 and 21, it gives us the interpretation that the ram is the Mede and Persian Empire, and the goat is the kingdom of Greece. And it tells us that a large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. And the first king of Greece was Alexander the Great. So as we begin this study, I want to give you a little story about Alexander, a little background on this that is a very fascinating thing. In order to get the impact of prophecy on our world and how God is so involved in the ways of men. Alexander, it is recorded in the annals of Josephus, the Jewish historian, who was a historian that took great care to record history in detail, and how he records how Alexander interacted with the Jewish people during his short reign of power. Alexander was only in power for about 12 years. He conquered the known world in 12 years. Alexander the Great had a dream, and this is recorded in Josephus, and the dream was that he saw men in white robes with one man coming with, from within them who was in a purple robe, approaching him. He didn't know the meaning of the dream, and he just went his way and was going about conquering various areas. Now, he had gotten such a reputation that there were times when he would come to conquer a city, and they would just simply meet him out at the gate of the city and say, "We don't want to fight you, come on in and take over," because he had such a reputation. So during this same time, Judea, the high priest in Jerusalem, as Alexander was moving on Jerusalem, Judea began to pray and ask the Lord what to do about this and seek for wisdom. The Lord instructed him to have the priests dress in their white robes and that he should put on his royal priestly garments, which were purple in color, and they should go out and meet Alexander. And Alexander, they went, in fact, and did that, and met Alexander the Great. And all the Jews gathered round Alexander to welcome him into the city. And Alexander the Great walked up and bowed down in front of the high priest. One of his generals came to him and asked him, "Alexander, why are you doing this? Why did you bow down to the high priest?" And Alexander said, "I did not bow to the high priest, but I bowed to his God, who gave me a dream and told me that I would see men in white robes and in a purple robe." The story goes on that the high priest took Alexander the Great and showed him the scroll of Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 8 here, and it showed where the Greeks were to overthrow the Medo-Persian Empire, and that this little horn would raise up, this horn would be, in fact, Alexander. And Alexander then granted that the Jews would be able to continue with their practice and their religion freely. He gave them many gifts and went on his way without shedding any blood in Jerusalem. This is recorded in history. You can find this in encyclopedias in the background of this. You can read it from the original author if you get the book on the Jewish historian Josephus. Fascinating stuff. Now, you say, okay, Chris, so why are you giving us a Jewish history lesson today? Why talk about Alexander the Great? Because it shows how God is involved in every aspect of what is happening, and it confirms the writings of Daniel chapter 8. If Daniel 8 is true, and I believe it clearly is, and we're going to look at how it interprets, how it lays out, then the point is that all other prophecy that is yet to take place is going to take place just as the Lord said it will take place. And we need to believe that God will fulfill it and that it should motivate us. It should change us. Prophecy, the Bible is a third prophecy at least. Some say more. And prophecy is something that should motivate us. It should purify us. It should make us consider that the Lord has told the truth and is going to continue to do it. Prophecy is something we should be very much involved in. Now, you say, but Chris, I'm like Daniel at the end of this thing. It says no one understood it. That's me. I don't understand it either. And you say, well, how can I understand it? Well, look, we're going to go through it, and you do the best you can to understand what you can. But don't put your brain on a shelf and don't put your Bible on the shelf. Study it out. Examine these things. If nothing else, I'd like to motivate you to examine and to look and to read and to find out what is true and come to your own conclusions. And some of those conclusions might disagree with my conclusions. The ultimate conclusion is that the Lord's coming back. We talked about that last week. We talked about the message title last week was "The Saints Win." And it's true. They do. We win in the end. The saints win. And if you didn't hear it, pick up the CD. Go on the internet and listen to it. Download it to your iPod. Get these things down. Start to come to an understanding that the Lord is coming. And I believe he's coming very, very soon. And I believe it could very well be in our lifetime. And that should radically affect us. And so, Daniel chapter 8, let's come to verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. So this is again before chapter 5. It's the second vision that followed after chapter 7. And he said, I saw in the vision, and so it happened while I was looking that I was at Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. That's Iran or Persia, Iran today. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Now, this river was a river that was 900 feet wide. It was man-made, 900 feet wide in some areas. It was like a canal. And Shushan, this area, would have been about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf today. And it's a province under Babylon. And we don't know if Daniel actually was physically translated there or in the spirit. I would seem to think that he was sort of translated in the spiritual realm. He saw this in the spiritual realm. It's a vision. And so it says, then I lifted my eyes and saw there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns, and two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Now, the higher than the other, the Medes and the Persians, Media-Persian Empire, the Medes were initially seemed to be the rulers, but then the Persians rose up and were higher, and in the end, it was really the Persians who were overseeing. And it says, and I saw them pushing westward, northward, and southward. And that's exactly how they moved in their conquering, if you study their wars. And so that no animal could withstand, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And I was considering, suddenly a male goat from the west and across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat and the notable horn between his eyes. It's sort of like a unicorn. So if you don't believe in unicorns, well, here's one in the Bible. And so Alexander the Great here is depicted as this goat with a notable horn between his eyes. The horn is sort of Alexander. And he came to the ram and had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him and attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in its place of it, four notable horns came toward the four winds of heaven. So we have this thing of this ram's horn. Now, it's interesting because Persian kings, when they went into battle, wore a golden ram's head. And they had a ram's head on their coins, and it's part of their culture. And the Babylonians, they moved in and took over Babylon. And the imagery that's before us is the Medes and Persians first move in, overrun Babylon. Then we have, and by the way, when Daniel's writing this, the Babylonians are still in control. He's still in Babylon. Belshazzar is the king of Babylon. So he's not yet even seen the Medes and Persians step into this. So that's the first thing in the prophecy, that the Medes and Persians would rise up and overcome Babylon. We see that back in chapter 2. And then we have the Greeks coming under Alexander the Great. Now, they were very brutal. Alexander, at 20 years old, Alexander came and was leading an army. And it's interesting because the odds were completely against him. The Medo-Persian Empire was so powerful, it's estimated they had an army of men of between 2 and 2.5 million men. During the major battle that Alexander engaged them, he only had 35,000 men, and he went against at least 300,000 in the battle. And so this is a David and Goliath kind of match going on here. And it says, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of the Medes and Persians. Verse 20 I'm reading. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. I just want to get clear with you that it identifies who these people are. The large horn that is between its eyes is that first king, Alexander the Great. And for the broken down horn and the four that stood in its place, four kingdoms shall rise out of that nation, but not with its power. So you have the Medo-Persian Empire, and then you have the Greeks coming against the Medo-Persian Empire with Alexander the Great being the one in the middle of that. And we see that in the writings of Josephus, that this is something that God was orchestrating behind the scenes, if you believe those historical writings, which I do. He's orchestrating what's happening as Alexander is being told about this, and he's coming in this way. And we see this ram, it comes and it has two horns, and then the two horns are wiped out. The goat comes along. Alexander, you know, again, even the Greeks used the goat as one of their symbols. Alexander actually named his own son August, which means son of a goat. So if you would like to have a name for one of your children, there's a beautiful name, son of a goat. And it tells us that he moved across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the idea there is he moved in this sort of cat-like manner in a very unique way. And he moved from the west. He came and the Greek Empire rose with great speed. The idea of not touching the ground. Alexander was certainly a notable horn. And he was confronting the ram with furious power. And this battle, again, is one of the greatest battles in history. And Alexander wins the battle. Now, what's interesting is Alexander the Great, it tells us that this man, this person will fall, but not with men. It tells us verse 25, and this is relating, I think, also to the Antichrist, but he says, and he shall be broken without human means. Alexander the Great comes on the scene and he ends up fighting, and that's also true of the Antichrist and also true of Antiochus Epiphanes. These men went down without being killed in battle. Alexander the Great got to the end. He got to the point where he said, I have no more worlds to conquer. And he began to weep. And then he had a party in order to make himself try to feel better because he was depressed. And he got drunk at the party, got pneumonia because it was raining, and died just short of 33 years old. Here's this man who had everything. He had all the world in his hand. He had his whole, you know, all the probably anything he wanted as far as women is concerned, as far as finances are concerned, as far as gold and silver and power and all those things. And yet, it didn't fulfill him. And at 32, he just cries out and says, there's no more worlds to conquer. What am I going to do? And that's how often men are. We get to this place where we conquer things. Men are conquerors by nature. And we conquer, and then we think, well, what else is there to do? Well, I encourage you to let God conquer your heart and yield yourself to him. So at the end of Alexander's reign, his kingdom is divided into four. And the four names of the four leaders who were divided, and it tells us that they were notable, but they did not come with the power of Alexander, not with the same power. And the four leaders were Cassandra, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And they ruled various areas. Cassandra over Greece, Lysimachus over Asia Minor, Seleucus over Syria and Israel, and Ptolemy over Egypt. But it took them 22 years. Now, Alexander conquered the known world in 12 years. It took these guys 22 years to divide up what he had conquered. So they had nowhere near the power that Alexander had in the overall world. But it's interesting when you look at Alexander the Great, because he was, as God guided history, using Alexander's passion to spread Greek culture, he brought about some amazing things. One of the things is we have the New Testament, which is written in what is called Koine Greek, which is one of the basic, simple Greeks. There's a couple different Greek languages, and Koine Greek was the language of the people. And Alexander the Great is the one that introduced Koine Greek into the culture. So we can thank him in a sense, that, or thank God that he moved Alexander in this direction so that we could have the Bible in a language that was easily understood by the people of that day in the New Testament. And we also know the Greek Septuagint was written during that time, just after Alexander the Great. So, which is where we get a lot of our translation from. The other thing is, the Greek Empire also built the roads that Paul the Apostle and other missionaries, Paul and Silas and Barnabas, traveled through in order to deliver the gospel. So, this movement of getting Alexander the Great into power is all under God's plan. And so, verse 9 says, and out of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down because of the transgression. An army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. So from these four generals, these four leaders, rises up one. And this one that rises up ends up moving toward the glorious land. Now clearly the glorious land is the land of Israel. This little horn is different from the little horn, I believe, in chapter 7. The little horn in chapter 7 is pointing directly to the end days and the Antichrist. This horn is a real historical figure that we have the background on. And we can identify this historical figure in the fulfillment of his horn and a person by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled over Syria and Israel under the Seleucid dynasty. Now, Israel's land was fought over in these between Ptolemy and Seleucid, and Antiochus III gained power and then turned it over to his son, who was very, very wicked. The word Epiphanes means illustrious one, which is pointing to deity. So in essence, this man was setting himself up to be a god. And the Jews actually referred to him as Antiochus Epimanes, not Epiphanes, Epimanes, which means the madman. So they were very concerned with this crazy leader they had. And the glorious land is clearly speaking of Israel and Jerusalem. And again, as you think of Israel, you think of Jerusalem. I've been to Jerusalem many times. And I'll tell you, it is a glorious land. But it is a strange land in the sense of this. You go there, And there's not really anything. There's no natural resources. There's nothing that would be a natural desire. It's not even that there's oil under there. They think there might be, but they don't know that there is oil there. So it's not like Jerusalem is some desirable place. And yet, it is very desirable in the heart of many men. There is, of course, the attraction of the Jews to Jerusalem because it's the city of the king. It's the city of David. It's turned over to them. Then, of course, the Christian connection to it is because our Lord Jesus Christ was crucified right outside the city of Jerusalem. And he lived there. And then the third great religion of this world also has an attraction to Israel, and that is Islam. And I really believe they have attraction to Jerusalem because the Jews and the Christians want it, and they don't want us to have it. Now, there are those, there in their writings, they claim that Muhammad went there. They claim that Abraham sacrificed Ishmael on the mountain in Jerusalem. But the Bible clearly says that was not Ishmael, but in fact it was Isaac on Mount Moriah, which is right outside of Jerusalem, or right on the outside border of the old city of Jerusalem. And so it is, again, the nerve center of civilization. It's where the truth of God flowed from. It's a place of peace in the millennial reign of Jesus, we know. And so it's a glorious land, and it's a place. And Antiochus Epiphanes is an accurate, dramatic, and fulfillment of prophecy. So much so that, listen, this man fulfilled so many of these prophecies of Daniel that critics insist that the book of Daniel must have been written after the events. And that's what one of the arguments is. They say that Daniel was written later because no one could be as accurate as this. Antiochus Epiphanes, he exerted dominion, and he did it in the exact way toward the south, toward the east, and toward the land of Israel. He murdered other rulers and persecuted the people, casting down, which the word says, cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He exalted himself as high as the priest of the host of heaven. He blasphemed God and commanded idolatrous worship to be directed toward himself. He raised himself as a god. He put a stop to temple sacrifices, just as is said here in the book of Daniel. He desecrated the place of the temple. He set up an image of Zeus in the temple and had sacrifices given to that image. Antiochus Epiphanes opposed God and seemed to prosper. He cast down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. And it's interesting because it says that he trampled them. Antiochus is famous for the persecution of the Jews. He wanted them to submit to Greek culture, and they would not submit to Greek culture. He suppressed the Jews, and it came to a head in December 168 BC, and he returned to defeat them from Alexandria. He orders his generals to seize Jerusalem on the Sabbath, erected this idol to Zeus, and desecrated the altar by offering a swine and sprinkling the pig's juices in the sanctuary. So we know that a pig was a non-kosher animal, and he did this purposely just to anger the Jews, just because he hated the Jews. And it led to what is called the Maccabean Revolt. And you might be familiar with this. Now, he hated the Jews and wanted to destroy them. And it's recorded that he killed nearly 100,000, some say more than 100,000 Jews. And it's the same spirit that was in Pharaoh, that was trying to stop the children of Israel to go into the wilderness, that was in Haman in the book of Esther, that was in Herod, who tried to kill Jesus and keep the seed of the Messiah from living. It's the same spirit that was in Hitler, and it's the same spirit that will be in Antichrist in the last days. This same evil wickedness, anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism, by the way, listen, is on the rise in our day. I was reading an article about the rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic incidences in the world over the past few years. And from 2008 to 2009, the increase was over 100% of anti-Semitic incidences or terroristic acts or treatment of Jews. And it's going on tremendously in Europe, in England. These places are, and of course, these are high population of Muslim population, and there's much of this happening throughout the world. And this man, Antiochus Epiphanes, hated the Jews. And in 1 Maccabees 1, 29 to 32, which the book of Maccabees, now just understand, in our Bible, We do not have the book of Maccabees, 1st and 2nd Maccabees. It is part of the canon of the Catholic Bible. This is the difference. The Catholic Bible has what's called the Apocrypha books, and Maccabees is one of them. And some of the Apocrypha books are just kind of strange, but the Maccabees particularly is really just a historical document. It records the wars of the Maccabean revolt. And in this, it tells us there that he did kill, in fact, 100,000, murdered 100,000 Jews. He persecuted Jews. And it goes on to talk about a particular battle, and we'll get to that in a moment. But verse 13 and 14 says, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said, so that the certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the sacrifices and the transgression of desolation and the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary will be cleansed." So we see this 2,300 days. The Bible students debate over this. Some say it means 2,300 days exactly. Some say it means, because the wording is morning and evening, so it could mean 1,150 days, divide it in half. And try to stay with me. I know this is tedious, but I need to get through this. Stay with me. But there's another teaching taught by a Baptist pastor named Miller, and it's the teaching of the Millerites. And they said that this 2,300 days was 2,300 years. And they claimed that that meant that Jesus was coming back in the year 1844. And so they went up to a mountain and waited on that mountain. And there was a woman by the name of Ellen G. White who was present with them. And they stood on the mountain and waited for Jesus to come back. And I don't know if you know, he didn't come. He didn't show up that day. They actually then claimed it was a spiritual thing and that he did come. And from that began the Seventh-day Adventist religion or teaching. And then also birthed out of that came the Jehovah Witnesses and some other movements, some that are really full-on cults. And so, you know, there's no evidence. He had no backing for that. The year-day theory was just something he sort of made up. And it's interesting because when you look at, though, the literal interpretation of this, saying it was 2,300 days, and this seems to be the most likely, is that the temple was cleansed in the Maccabean revolt in December 25th, 165 BC. What happened was Antiochus Epiphanes went and tried to sacrifice a pig, and a man named Mattathias refused to take part in the pig sacrifice, and he and his sons rose up and did a little damage to the Syrian army of that day and fought against them. But his sons, Mattathias was killed, but his sons formed a guerrilla warfare group that ultimately defeated the Syrian army and took back Jerusalem and the temple. And they did so on December 25th, 165 BC. If you take 2,300 days and back up from that exact date, it comes to the very year and the time in which Antiochus Epiphanes began the persecution of the Jews. So it's very simple. He said, how long is this going to last? The desecration of the temple, the not having sacrifices, 2,300 days, and you can see that clearly. Now, what's also interesting in this is this led to Judas Maccabeus. You know, again, this is recorded in the historical books of Maccabees. He came to the temple and they only had enough oil to keep the lamp burning for one day. And they prayed and asked that the Lord would sustain the burning of the lamp. And it needed to burn for 8 days. And there was only 1 day's worth of oil. And miraculously, the lamp burned for 8 days. And that, of course, is the Feast of Lights, or what we come to know of, and it's December 25th, and it is why the Jews celebrate Hanukkah, right? And so that is where that all comes from. And did it really happen? Well, I think probably it did, because Jesus went to the temple in John 22 for the celebration of the Feast of Lights. So it was a feast that Jesus recognized. Now, this amazing specific prophecy was written down 350 years before Antiochus Epiphanes came on the scene. Guys, this is amazing. Great fulfillment of prophecy, and it demonstrates that God knows the future, and he's the only one who knows the future, and he guides the future, as we saw through Alexander and that whole scenario. It's fascinating stuff. So now we come to the first angel in the Bible, and this is amazing. Here you go all the way through. We have the ram, the goat, and now we have Gabriel. Gabriel the angel. Now, I don't know if you realize this, but all the way through the Bible, we have angels appearing in places, and we have the angel of the Lord appearing, and we believe that many times that's an appearance of Christ. But here we have an angel being named for the very first time in the whole Bible, Gabriel. Well, I mean, you can make an argument that Lucifer was the other one that's named and the timing of that, but Lucifer is a fallen angel, so we won't count him for now. But Gabriel is mentioned here. And by the way, other angels, there are not a lot of names of angels given in the Bible. Gabriel is one, and we know that it comes on the scene here in Daniel. He then later seems to be put in charge of birth announcements because he shows up and he tells Zacharias that they're having a baby, and then he tells Mary that she's going to be with child. And then the only other name that we have other than Lucifer, who is really a cherub, which is probably a line of the angels, some category, but we have Michael the archangel. And that's the only other name that's given of an angel in Scripture. And it is Michael the archangel, which probably means he's the only one of them. There's no other. It's not like there's a band of archangels. Just Michael the archangel. Okay, so we come to verse 15. Then it happened when Daniel had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. You know, he's basically saying, this boy needs help. And so do we, right, as we read this. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Notice that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright and said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter times of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. So, we see he's in between these banks of the river. Gabriel comes along and we see that he tells him it is for the latter time, or the time of indignation, commonly referred to as the end times or the last days. And, you know, this is where prophecy and people get into differing opinions of this. Because some would say Daniel chapter 8 is totally self-contained and has been fulfilled completely in the person of Antiochus Epiphanes, the final section there, and that's it. And that's true. It was fulfilled in that. But what I would say to you is this is also a picture or a type of Antichrist. Because just as we see all the way through the Old Testament, there are men who are raised up who are types of Christ. Like Joseph was a type of Christ. Like Isaac is a type of Christ. When Abraham takes Isaac up to the mountain and lays him on the sacrifice and is about to put him to death, Isaac was a type of Christ. In some ways, Daniel is a type of Christ. David certainly is a type of Christ through the Scriptures. And just as there are those who are types in that way, we have this man, Antiochus Epiphanes, who I believe is a type of Antichrist. And we'll see the parallels as we go through this. So he says, the vision refers to the time of the end. And the answer is that though prophecy is fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes, there is a later fulfillment in the Antichrist, and it's the idea of the near and the far. And in prophecy, this is something that I believe is very prevalent. As you read through the minor prophets, through Isaiah, through Ezekiel, you see the near and the far. You see something that is relevant to their current history or soon history, and it's relevant to that situation there, but then it is also to the far, or looking forward with the lens to the last days. And that's what I believe is taking place here. And just as Antiochus Epiphanes rose to power with force and intrigue, so will the Antichrist. Just as he persecuted the Jews, so will Antichrist. Just as he stopped the sacrifice and desecrated the temple, so will Antichrist. And just as he seemed to be a complete success, so will the Antichrist seem that. For what Antichrist did to the Jews, one man said, in his day, therefore one may know the general pattern of what the Antichrist, what Antichius did, so will the Antichrist do to them in the future. So it tells us in verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, that is those four kings, when the transgressions have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes. In other words, there's demonic power behind this. His power, verse 24 says, shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, or you'll be in great awe of him, and shall prosper and thrive, and he shall destroy the mighty, verse 24, and also the holy people. God's people will be greatly impacted by this man, were by this man, Antiochus Epiphanes, and will be by Antichrist. Remember, the time of the tribulation period is referred to as Jacob's trouble. It is primarily God's dealing with the Jews, with the nation of Israel in that final 7-year period of world history. And it is dealing with primarily the Jews. Now, there'll be lots of other people alive during that time. There'll be lots of people who will come to Christ during that time. There'll be 144,000 Jewish evangelists traveling all around, preaching the gospel. There'll be two men risen from the dead in the center of the city of Jerusalem. And they'll raise up and they'll preach the everlasting gospel. There'll be lots of things happening, but it is primarily the time of Jacob's trouble. It is the dealing of God with the Jews. And so it says, through his cunning, notice verse 25. This is a very important verse. Tune in. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And it's very interesting because the book of Maccabees uses that term for him. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, that being the Lord himself. But he shall be broken without human means. Now look at that again. He shall, through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. Now, of course, we've never seen a politician who's done anything like this. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. This guy's going to raise himself up. And we're seeing again, this man, Antiochus Epiphanes, but this is exactly what the Antichrist will also do. And 2 Thessalonians tells us, and look at the final, this is the greatest part. Look at the final sentence of chapter 25, or verse 25. But he shall be broken without human means. Just like Alexander died that way, the Antiochus Epiphanes actually died as he raised himself up. He raised his fist against God and declared that he would kill more Jews than any other man. And it says that he fell off his horse and was eaten with worms from the inside out. Gross, right? Just like Herod was in the book of Acts, was eaten with worms. God's got some special worms for these guys. But, you know, it's interesting because Antichrist will not be struck in battle. It's not like Jesus will come out of heaven with a spear and you know, he'll fire his spear of flame into the heart of Antichrist and he'll explode like they'd show on TV or something. No, it's going to simply be by the brilliance of his coming, 2 Thessalonians says. That's what it says. He will be defeated by the brilliance of his coming. Jesus is just going to show up and he's going to be in such glory that the Antichrist is going to be tied up, just defeated completely right then and there. Without human means. We won't need to nuke him. Jesus will deal with him. We'll Jesus him. No nukes necessary. And the power of Jesus is just so overwhelming. You know, sometimes we think the power of Satan and the power of God are like, you know, Satan's here and God's here and Jesus and they're battling and there's like this battle and Satan comes up like this and Jesus comes up like that and then Satan and it's kind of back. It's not like that. Satan is like a little worm. He's nothing to the Lord. And the Lord will just, you know, just going to one day just going to squish him. It's going to be over. And so we're going to see these things. They will take place. He shall be broken without human means, just as Antiochus Epiphanes was. And it's interesting, as you look at this, and the parallels continue, having fierce features, Antiochus Epiphanes was known for his cruelty and brutality, and that will also be the legacy of the Antichrist. You know, he will kill millions. You study the book of Revelation, the Antichrist will put to death millions. Even in that first 3.5 years, millions will die. And some even estimate over 1 billion people, even in the first 3.5 years. And he'll have sinister schemes. Certainly an Antichrist will be scheming. His power shall be mighty, but not his own power. It's going to be satanic. He'll prosper and thrive. You know, the Antichrist is going to be accepted at first. It's not going to be just where this, you know, he's not going to come on the scene and be like, nyeh-uh-uh. He's going to come on the scene and he's going to be really somebody that you'd look at and go, wow, man, what's some great, those are great ideas. Boy, we should have those things. Wouldn't it be great if everyone had that? Wouldn't it be just wonderful if the whole world was as one and we could all sing Imagine? You know, wouldn't that be wonderful? But he shall prosper and thrive, and he shall destroy the mighty and the holy, it tells us. Antiochus did this, and the coming Antichrist will destroy and persecute. And he shall cause deceit to prosper. 2 Thessalonians 9:10, speaking of the Antichrist, says, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and living wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And he'll magnify himself in his heart. 2 Thessalonians 2:4 says, he that sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. That's what the Antichrist is going to do. And he shall even rise against the prince of princes. He'll come up against the Lord. And he hates the Jews. He hates, there's a hatred, there's this anti-Semitism that's behind this. But without human hands, he'll be defeated. So verse 26, it says, the vision of the evenings and the mornings which was told is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And the vision was sealed up until these things took place. And it's not sealed up now, because remember in the book of Revelation, John said, who is worthy to open the seal? Remember that? And we know that there was a lamb as though he'd been slain. John was weeping because no one was worthy to open the seal. But the lamb, as though he'd been slain, was worthy. And he opened the seal and he revealed the truth. And we see the seals being broken in the book of Revelation. So he says, I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Now you understand, right? I love the honesty of Daniel here. First, he says he fainted. He was sick. And you know, there are things in this vision, when you think about the last days, you think about what was happening here. Daniel, I'm sure, was sick to his heart because of the awful things that were going to happen to the city of Jerusalem, to Israel. And when we think of the things that are going to take place in the last days, it should make us sick. It should break our hearts. We should be motivated as believers to share the gospel that much more. We should realize that God is going to judge this world, but and it's hard to understand. It's hard to grasp. But at the same time, it should make us weep. It should break our hearts. When I've been to Israel and I walk around there and I see these young Jewish people and living there, and I think these are the ones that are probably going to face Jacob's trouble and the wrath of the Lamb on the Christ-rejecting world. And we should be sick about those things. And it should give us passion. And we should be astonished, because it says Daniel was astonished. And prophecy, listen, prophecy should astonish you. I know that these things are a little tedious to go through. You say, Pastor Chris, why are you going through a whole chapter on Sunday morning of the book of Daniel? Can't you just pick some nice little bitty from the psalm, nice little ditty, and give us something where you feel good, and we walk out of here, and we go, oh man, wasn't that sweet? Well, I guess I could do that. And I've struggled. Daniel's a tough book. I told my wife, you know, man, this is hard to study, to read, to understand, and to present it to you guys. But it should be something that should give us a passion for people, a desire for his word, a passion for prophecy, a desire, because if this prophecy was fulfilled this way, and it is a foreshadowing of the Antichrist, then the Lord is going to fulfill what he says he's going to do. He's going to do this. These things really are going to happen. And I know if you're the water cooler and, you know, tomorrow morning and you stand there and you say, did you know there's a guy coming on the scene by the name of Antichrist? And he's going to, just, you know, do a lot of damage. And if you don't get right with Jesus, you're going to be burned up and killed. And you say that and they're going to go, you're crazy. Call the white jackets, you know. But we need to realize that God is going to judge this world and he is going to fulfill what he says. And it says that Daniel was about the king's business. And listen, that really spoke to my heart. What should we be doing? Jesus said to occupy until I come. See, the danger is, there's two dangers when you study prophecy. One danger is it overwhelms you and you go, that's crazy. I can't even deal with that. I can't even, I'm just going to live my life and, you know, buy a new car, something like that. The other danger is you get so entrenched in it that you don't even, you miss people. You don't realize that it's about people. So we need to have that balance of being brokenhearted over what is going to happen and realizing it's really going to happen, but then going about our king's business. And who is our king? Jesus Christ is our king. And we need to be about our king's business. What is our king's business? He said to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, and by this, all men will know you are my disciples by your love one for another. By your love one for another. By this, all men will know you are my disciples. And the king's business is to go into all the world and preach the gospel, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and Holy Spirit. And lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. This is the king's business. This is what the Lord has for us, is that we might be about the king's business. And Daniel was about the business of his king. In that day, we need to serve Jesus with all our heart. Daniel was one who had a heart for the people and wanted to impact his world for Christ. You know, I liken Daniel sometimes in my mind to the Apostle Paul. You know, the Apostle Paul was chained to Roman guards for 6 hours at a time. And I'm going to tell you, I think those guys, Paul maybe got 1 hour of sleep and the rest of the time was a 5-hour gospel message for every one of those guards. And every 6 hours they'd rotate the guards and Paul would just go, oh, here comes another one. The story is told of Gordon Maxwell, a missionary to India, that when he asked a Hindu scholar to teach him the language, the Hindu replied, no, Sahib, I will not teach you my language. You would make me a Christian. Gordon Maxwell replied, you misunderstand me. I'm simply asking you to teach me your language. Again, the Hindu replied, no, Sahib, I will not teach you. No man can live with you and not become a Christian. It's true. And I think that was true of the Apostle Paul, and I think it should be true of our lives. I think we should be ones that are in the ministry of reconciliation. I'll close with these verses in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 17 to 21. Mark it down. Meditate on this week. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. Now all things are of God, who has reconciled us to himself through Jesus Christ and has given us, listen, the ministry of reconciliation. God has given us the ministry of reconciliation. And whether you believe that this is completely all just has already taken place and isn't even foreshadowing the Antichrist, and that's a view, whether even if you believe that, well, we still have the ministry of reconciliation. We still are to reconcile people to Christ. And here's what he goes on to say. He says, that is that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not imputing their trespasses to them, and has committed to us the word of reconciliation. You have the word of reconciliation for that person you meet on the street. And let me tell you, as I said earlier, you know, you meet somebody on the street, you know, they don't care about pre-trib, post-trib, mid-trib, all millennial, pre-millennial. They don't care about that stuff. You just tell them, hey, your sins can be forgiven. You can be reconciled to God through Christ. They can argue about that once they're in the church already. Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ. As though God were pleading through us, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. And today, if you don't know Jesus Christ, if you've not yet yielded to Christ, I plead with you, I implore you, be reconciled to God today. Come home to him. Put your trust in him. For he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Him who knew no sin became sin, that you might be reconciled, that you might be righteous. Today is the day of salvation. Now is the appointed time. You want to be a new creation? Old things will be passed away. Everything will become new if you give your heart to Jesus Christ. So fulfilled prophecy, it purifies us. He who has this hope purifies himself, reminds us that he did it before and he will fulfill his word yet to come. He motivates us that we need to share our Lord with our loved ones, with people we know, to minister to them.